It's a July morning in 2021, and we are in Makua Valley, joining a cultural access with Malama Makua. It's hot already at 8 a.m. and dry. We hope for cloud cover or a breeze, anything to soften the intense heat of the Waianae sun. At the locked gate, almost at the end of Farrington Highway, a military staffer asks for our photo IDs and checks our names against the roster of participants submitted by Malama Makua. After about a dozen and a half people arrive, we gather in a pavilion in the front of the valley for introductions and our safety briefing. One of our guides for the day is Uncle Sparky Rodriguez, a Malama Makua board member we heard from in the last episode. In his introduction, Uncle Sparky invites us to envision a different Makua, not a Makua filled with bombs and military contaminants, but a Makua that's home to a flourishing community.
So today, as you're going around, think about the ancestors walking with you. What would they be saying? What are they looking at? What are they seeing? If you're able to imagine 1,000 years ago, what sounds would you hear? Would they be making kapa or pounding pork? Or would they be feeding the pigs or going out with their canoes to go fishing?
Auntie Lynette Cruz, the president of Malama Makua, shared about her family's ties with the military.
I don't think I've ever introduced myself in this way. My husband, my first husband, died from exposure to Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. I don't think I ever told anybody that. I don't think about it. My father served in Korea, in the Korean conflict. So our family ties with the military were tied, historically tied. I have to remind myself all the time that before that, we already had history. I live in Waianae. I think I've been back on the board for about 5 or 6 years. We were locked out of this valley for over a year. And that was kind of rough because we didn't really know what to do. How do you belong on space that you don't have access to?
During the first year of the COVID pandemic, cultural access in Makua was shut down by the army, up until a few months before this access date in July 2021. After signing liability releases and receiving a safety briefing from the Army about the unexploded ordnance in the valley, we set out up a gravel road to our first stop, the Makua Ahu. I'm Kenji Cataldo, and you're listening to Before Us. In this series, Makua Piku of Peace, we're diving into the ongoing history of the U.S. military occupation of Hawaii and of Kanaka Maoli of Native Hawaiians fighting for the return and restoration of their land. Our focus is the story of Makua, a sacred valley on the island of Oahu that was appropriated by the Army during World War II to use for training. We began our story last episode across the highway at Makua Beach. We heard from Uncle Sparky Rodriguez and Uncle Vince Dodge about the village community living on the beach. We learned how the state evicted the community from the beach and how the organizing council of the village, the Makua Council, joined forces with peace and justice activists who were concerned about the army training in the valley. Together, they became the organization Malama Makua. If you didn't catch that episode, I would recommend pausing now and listening to episode 1 first. Before continuing up the path to the Ahu, we need to catch up on the story of how we were even inside the gate in the first place, how Malama Makua secured cultural access for the community inside the valley that had been fenced off for decades.
Let's see, it all evolved out of our effort, the Hawaiian perspective of the Aina being part of our family and being connected. And the fence, which I call the fence of violence, which was keeping us separated. So the army military had control of one side and the community had the other. But the state and the county were so influenced by the militarization that whatever they wanted, the military wanted, it was almost carte blanche, okay. And a lot of community members, because of the military's influence and their serving and part of their enlistment and their role in military, there's a lot of loyalty for the military. They need to train, they need to be able to do that. And the perspective of the Aina being our mother and our parent, How are we treating our parent? How are we allowing that abuse, the bombing, the training, the bullets, treating our Aina that way? In that interim, when we were starting to discover each other, the Hawaiian component of Aina and then the Feast and Justice for Equity, we found that there were some similarities in relationships that we could agree on. And the abuse is one of them. So when Leandra and I first went to Sierra Club Legal Defense to ask for help, we said, we've got a whole bunch of Hawaiians out there that we need to be able to access the Aina for healing. And they said, sorry, we cannot, we don't do people. You know, we only do endangered species. So I shared, we're endangered species. And they said, no, no, we cannot do people. We can only do environmental endangered species. So with that, it changed our idea and our focus of who are we representing? And the ones we were looking at representing at that point was the Hawaiians that had no voice. So all the endangered species became our message. These are Hawaiians that have no voice, and this is what's going on. So once that happened, we were able to talk to Earth Justice, and they said, well, we don't do people, we do Aina, I mean, endangered species. So that's where it happened. And then we said, okay, well, we need to protect the valley and stuff like that. So David Henkin, who was the attorney at the time, met with Fred and I and Leandra, and we were talking about the responsibility of the board to taking on a lawsuit. So basically, Fred and I were the only ones that was really working that had any economic stability at the time. And we had to go ahead and realize that we were placing all of our material, wealth, whatever that was, on the line for Makua. And if we lost, it would come out of our pocket. So there's a tremendous risk for the undertaking, not knowing what the hell we were doing.
So the most important part of the conversation with Malama Makua was expectation setting.
That's David Henkin, the lawyer from Sierra Legal Defense Fund, now Earth Justice, who met with Malama Makua.
And just at the time that we undertook this litigation in 1998, I'm not aware of any court, federal or state, that had ever told the military that they couldn't do live fire training because they might be violating an environmental law. So in the conversations with Malama Makua, we had to make very clear what we thought we could accomplish. And what we thought we could accomplish was to get them the information that they desired about what are the impacts on the environment, what's happening to my kids if they play in the muliwai, you know, how are the contaminants affecting the fish and the limu that we gather, what's happening to the sacred sites, and also to force the Army to look at alternatives, but not necessarily to choose those alternatives if they didn't want to. And at the time that we started this effort in the 90s, the local newspapers, and at that time Honolulu had two, the Star Bulletin and the Honolulu Advertiser, both of them were very hostile to what Malama Makua was doing. And if you go back to the ways, the spin on the stories was, you know, they're trying to erode readiness and undermine national security. There was no understanding of the other side of the picture.
David explained that there were two legal options for them to pursue.
The law that we thought was really the one that was most likely we were going to win on, the National Environmental Policy Act, purely procedural. So it can get you the information, but it can't necessarily get you the result you want. And they said, that's okay. You know, we're going to use that information. We want that information. We want it so we can protect our families if there's contamination going into the ocean that we need to be worried about, and we can use it politically. The other tool was the Endangered Species Act, because the Army had never done a comprehensive consultation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is required under the Endangered Species Act. Anytime a federal agency is undertaking an activity with the potential to harm, threaten, or endangered species.
In 1998, the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund sent a notice letter to the Army that they would sue them for violation of the Endangered Species Act in 60 days, a requirement under that law.
We knew the training and related activities, like the prescribed burns that they would do in the valley to keep the fuel load down. We knew that those burned up into the native forest ringing the valley, and that there were, at that time, not only the endangered tree snails, but by the time that we were bringing the lawsuit, Earth Justice, at that time Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, had gotten nearly 200 plant species added to the endangered species list, of which a couple, several dozen were in the mountains surrounding Makua. So in September of 1998, we sent a notice of intent to sue to the Army saying, if you don't stop training and start consulting Fish and Wildlife Service, we're going to take you to court. About 2 weeks after we sent that notice letter, the Marines were out training at Makua. And as with any training, sometimes you miss, and they were firing mortar rounds. And one of those mortars fell outside of the firebreak road, and it hit the center ridge between Makua and Kahanaiki. And it started an 800-acre blaze outside of the firebreak road up into the native forest.
4 o'clock, they leave. The valley's still burning. And it burns for 3 days. The entire valley was cooked. And that is what got us into court.
I think they saw the writing on the wall, and they realized that they needed to stop training and finish this consultation. So they did. So they immediately announced that they were voluntarily suspending training. And when we reached out to the press, we said, yeah, what they failed to mention is that they voluntarily suspended training after getting our notice letter, and they confirmed that the notice letter factored into their decision making. So they stopped all training at Makua in September of 1998 so they could start consulting Fish and Wildlife Service.
The Army's consultation with Fish and Wildlife under the Endangered Species Act was completed in 1999. But before that, while the Army training was on pause, Malama Makua and the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund also initiated a lawsuit under the National Environmental Policy Act.
We filed suit in October of 1998, challenging their failure to ever do any environmental review at any level under the National Environmental Policy Act. And that was, in terms of the legal merits of that claim, it was a very strong claim that they needed to do something and they never had. And I think they realized that, and on top of it, they were not training because they were consulting under the Endangered Species Act.
In September 1999, Malama Makua and the Army reached a settlement agreement.
We didn't have to actually get the court to decide the legal issues, and the Army said, okay, we will not resume training until we've completed at least an environmental assessment.
An environmental assessment is a more preliminary analysis than an environmental impact statement that determines whether or not there is the potential for impact on the environment. A yes means you have to go on to do a full EIS, and a no leads to a FONSI, a finding of no significant impact. In this case, it was obvious that there was potential impact from the training, and David said so to the Army lawyer.
So I said to my Army counterparts, you got to be kidding me. I mean, you stopped training because you burned up 800 acres of native habitat with full of endangered species. We know that you have damaged cultural sites. We know that you've burned up toxins in the back of the valley. How can you say with a straight face that there's no potential for any significant effect on the human environment? And they responded, under the law, we're entitled to start with an environmental assessment. And as long as we're not training, what's it to you? I was like, okay, yeah, we're not harmed as long as you're not training, and you're going to have to do an environmental impact statement, you know that. And they said, well, we're going to do the environmental assessment first. And I said, okay, I can tell you right now that if you come out with a finding of no significant impact, we're going to take you back to court and we're going to win, and I don't want to have to scramble because you're starting training again. So if you come out with a FONSI, this agreement, settlement agreement, is going to say you're going to wait 30 days before you do any training so I can go back to court and try and get the judge to stop you. They're like, okay.
While the Army worked on the environmental assessment to comply with the National Environmental Policy Act, The other course of action under the Endangered Species Act delivered a powerful result through the consultation with the Fish and Wildlife Service.
The Fish and Wildlife Service concluded that there were at least 27 species of Hawaiian plants that were threatened with extinction. Not just harm, extinction. By training at Makua, because in Hawaii we have a high degree of endemism. In other words, there are plants that are found in some valleys and nowhere else on God's green earth. I've never seen a conclusion like that. Nonetheless, in 2000, the Army came out with a finding of no significant impact for training at Makua, and as promised, we immediately went back to court. There was a lot of jousting back in court. They actually withdrew that initial environmental assessment and then sanitized it and got rid of everything that suggested that anything could possibly go wrong. And then they reissued that. Their environmental assessment was so blatant, it attached the biological opinion from the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they literally whited out the parts on the chart that said 27 species that are likely to be jeopardized, in other words, pushed to extinction. They just whited that out as if we wouldn't notice.
A quick correction, David shared later it was actually 30 species that were threatened with extinction by the Army's training in Makua.
And then they announced in early 2001 that they were going to return to live fire training. And so we were in a very difficult situation because, to my knowledge, no court had ever told the military that they couldn't train based on violation of environmental law. And this environmental law wasn't even substantive. It didn't even have thou shalts in it. It just said, it's a procedure. You need to be honest about what the impacts are. And if you still want to do that, you can do it, and it's up to politics. So it was challenging, but we really didn't have any choice. We wanted to protect the valley from further harm, and so in July of 2001, we asked the court to issue what's called a preliminary injunction.
The Army and Malama Makua presented their arguments around what's called the balance of harm, on who would be harmed more, the Army by not being able to train, or Malama Makua by the resumption of training.
The Army was arguing that national security was at stake, that this is a vital training area, and that basically the Republic would fall if the court doesn't allow them to return to training. And our argument was, you haven't fired a bullet there since September of 1998. Here we are in the middle of 2001. With the way that soldiers rotate on and off the island, no soldier in any Hawaii-based unit, Army, Marines, what have you, has done training. And that was any training, not just live fire, any training at Makua. But all of them said that they were ready to do their wartime mission. And so we said, these claims of national security are baseless. They're pure rhetoric. They're not based in fact. And we presented the evidence of the harm of burning up native forests to endangered species, the harm of destroying cultural sites, the threat of toxins going to nearshore areas where families fish for subsistence and children play, and on and on. And really, to my surprise, because this had never happened before, in July of 2001, the district court here in Honolulu ruled in our favor and issued a preliminary injunction and said, Army, you can't train.
This unprecedented judicial decision, like the Fish and Wildlife Service report, flew in the face of the overwhelmingly favorable treatment that the military was used to receiving in Hawaii. While David had cautioned Malama Makua at the beginning of the legal battle not to get their hopes up, the lawsuits under the Endangered Species Act and National Environmental Policy Act had delivered some surprising results. Still, neither at this point offered a clear way to end live fire training permanently. At this time, in the summer of 2001, the Army was temporarily stopped from going back to training by the preliminary injunction. But an unexpected event dramatically shifted the situation.
It was short-lived because in September 11, 2001, 9/11 happened, and it totally changed the calculus. There was no question that if the military went back to court and argued about the balance of harms, the United States had just been attacked, and they needed to immediately deploy to war in Afghanistan. And I knew that if they asked for that, they were going to get it.
Malama Makua was faced with a difficult situation. After 9/11, the army was sure to win an argument about needing to go back to train. So how could they best protect the valley? Malama Makua had two main choices. Either they could take their chances in court and make an argument against all odds that the army should not be allowed to train. If they lost, they would have little means to continue protecting the valley. Or they could settle with the army out of court and try to place some limitations and conditions on the army's return to training to mitigate the impact it would have, which to some sounded like making a deal with the enemy. It was a hard, soul-searching moment for the members of Malama Makua, and not everyone agreed. In the end, the decision to settle out of court won out, and David worked with Malama Makua on a settlement agreement.
It's an amazing agreement that got hammered out in 17 days, which is extraordinarily fast. With the court, they were going to push in court, and if we pulled it together in 17 days, and to get the approvals on the federal side in 17 days is insane.
The Army's desire to return to training in Makua as quickly as possible meant that Malama Makua had leverage, and they took advantage of this opportunity to make big asks. They asked for and received an allotment of $50,000 to hire independent peer review of the Army's environmental studies. The Army had to clear the front 1,000 meters of the valley of unexploded ordnance to lower the risk to beachgoers and vehicles driving past. And the Army was limited to a small number of days of training each year, in contrast to the unlimited training of the decades before. There was also a clause inserted that has had hugely important, unexpected consequences. Here's board member Uncle Vince Dodge.
Basically, everything we asked them for, they gave us. You know, I mean, their mission was to go back and train immediately, and they were kind of, it seemed like it was like, okay, if you give us that, we'll just give you whatever you want. And very importantly is the clause in the agreement that says, that our lawyer, David Henkin, put in, that says, if the Army doesn't complete the environmental impact statement at the agreed time, which would have been 3 years, which would have been October 2004, then the Army will not be able to use the valley for live fire training until it does complete that environmental impact statement. And the result of that and the Army's own decisions is that they have not published a record of decision. So they've completed the study, but they haven't completed the process. And so they haven't been back to train since the summer of 2004. Not a single bullet, much less a mortar or a bomb, has been fired in Makua Valley. And for us, that's really a testament to the power of the valley and the valley coming back, you know.
The clause giving the Army a 3-year deadline to submit an EIS or else not be able to train brought about an end to live fire training in the valley. But it wasn't a guaranteed outcome. It was the Army's own decision not to file the EIS that made that happen, and they could have satisfied this requirement and gone back to training at any point. Throughout the years, Malama Makua wasn't sure that the peace would hold, but it did. This lawsuit under the National Environmental Policy Act, a purely procedural law, as David explained, and the sustained activism of Malama Makua brought an end to live fire training in the valley.
Aloha Aina is my lifestyle and my hobby. 96792 is where you'll find me. Proud Hawaiian, got the lahui beside me. Ma hope and ma ko, o lili ulani. Aloha Aina is my lifestyle and my hobby. 96792 is where you'll find me. Proud Hawaiian, got the lahui beside me. We want Makua back, kick them colonizers out. Rest in peace to Pili La'au. He did what he had to in a tough situation, but no more will we bow to colonization.
Another important condition of the settlement agreement was that the Army had to support 2 days, sunrise to sunset, of cultural access each month, and 2 overnight access dates for the opening and closing makahiki ceremonies. The Army was now obligated indefinitely to support cultural access in the valley, including maintenance and personnel costs. This requirement of the out-of-court settlement has created space over the past 2 decades for thousands of community members to come to Makua and to build their own relationships with the valley. Uncle Sparky likes to say that he's just the doorman, and his job is to make sure that that door stays open. For the first 15 years or so, cultural access was facilitated by Auntie Leandra and Uncle Fred for as long as they were able. Since then, Uncle Sparky, Uncle Vince, Auntie Lynette, and others have carried that responsibility forward, holding space for the community to have the chance to know and connect with Makua. And it is that battle and decades of dedicated presence that allowed us to be in the valley this hot July day in 2021. We walked up the gravel road to our first stop, Makua Ahu. It's one of 3 ahu, or built stone altars, in the valley. Each ahu is dedicated to a different part of the valley system. What's referred to as Makua Valley is actually a system of 2 valleys and a smaller gulch enclosed by a semicircle of mountains and opening out to the sea. Starting as distinct valleys higher up in the mountains, they merge into a single valley extending down to the beach. Makua lies in the center. To the north is Kahana Haiki, and the small gulch on the southern side is Ko'iahi. Old-timers also used to include the adjacent ahupua'a of Keava'ula and Ohikilolo as part of Makua. Members of Malama Makua and friends constructed these 3 ahu as places to give ho'okupu, offerings, like flowers, sea salt, and lei, to the valley. At Makua Ahu, we're guided by Taylor and Anela, 2 experienced kia'i, or guardians, who are part of Malama Makua.
Uncle Vance like to say it's a user-friendly ahu. So,
It's noa. Yeah, so noa. So what that mean really is you do your oli, you give ho'okupu, and you feel the wind, the makane, the ua, and then you just, noa. Yeah. So for the oli part, make sure you don't do any olis, yeah? You don't video, record, none of that, yeah? Oli is sacred, it's kapu for the aina, for the honua, for your uhane, it's not for social media. So no camera filming while we do ho'okupu anywhere, okay? You know?
We oli and give our ho'okupu. Today, we're going to all 3 ahu to give ho'okupu and build our connection with each part of the valley. As we walk between ahu, I ask some of the other people there that day for their thoughts, starting with Nathan Rout, a kia'i and board member with genealogical ties to Makua.
Born and raised out in Makaha back in the 70s and 80s. So most of my childhood I spent was playing in the waters at Makua Beach. Back on a time when the fish, marine life, actually outnumbered the people. Grew up. Makua Valley always being excluded from my life because of the gates. So here we are now, present day. I still come down to Makua Beach to use. Just recently working on my genealogy, I found out one of my distant relatives actually held land inside Makua up to at least 1913. And it's documented. There's a picture of his house. There's an LAC number matching to his lot. So now that I know that my kupuna once lived here, he had property, he had things going on, part of my Hawaiian kuleana, it's not, I gotta take care of Tutu's yard.
My name is Charisma and I'm from Eva Beach. And this is my first time here in Makua Valley. We used to come to this beach and then I'm a surfer, or like I used to just sit in the water with my bodyboard and just look back into the valley and always wondered like what was back there because it's so beautiful. But just knowing that like that was used as like target practice and there's unexploded ordinances, I always just wonder like how it used to be back in the day, like when my ancestors or kupuna were living here.
Aloha, I'm Ulana Kalahiki Anthony, born and raised on the east side, Kane'ohe. I am a product of the Hawaiian immersion program from kindergarten up to 12th grade. And yeah, big, actively involved in my culture. Growing up in the immersion atmosphere, you always learn mo'olelo or stories of these sacred, special spots to us. And coming out, you know, you always drive past and it's beautiful, preserved, but it's also secured. And just not being able to access it, you always kind of wonder what's back there. And then you learn about the name and Makua meaning parent. Why would they give such a special name to a place like that? So it's just real interesting, real special.
Yeah, what were some of the mo'olelo that you would hear about Makua?
Oh man, just about how plentiful it was over here. And it makes sense because when you think of Makua or parents, you think about like how well they take care of their children and protect them. And that's exactly the kind of stories or themes the stories would hold. It's just how this Aino would protect her keiki and feed them and for generations.
I think I would mostly hear about the cave where the half shark, half man lived and how he would just kind of lure people in. But my parents would use that to kind of scare me as to not go in that area kind of thing. But as far as Makua Valley, I didn't hear much until today. Like, I learned more. So, yeah.
My name is Taylor Chang, and I am from Kaimuki. And I, born and raised in Hawaii. Family, dad's side came from Maui, Chinese Hawaiian side, and my mother, full Japanese, from Aiea. And you know, I just it was like it must be like 3-4 years ago. I just attended an access, one of the cultural access, and with Uncle Vince, Uncle Sparky, Auntie Lynette were there, and I just kept feeling like I needed to be called back, and so I just kept coming up. I just kept coming back every single access. Sort of, I didn't miss any for a while, and over time, I just sort of kept coming, and I can't really explain why. It just felt right for me to show up.
I never understood what my connection to Makua was. So 4 years ago, I was invited into the valley by Uncle Vince Dodge. Took me 2 years to finally say, what the hell, let's go. And ever since then, I've been coming to Makua pretty frequently. Then one day I decided I want to work on my genealogy. And that's when I started going through everything, this and that, not realizing until one axis, I was looking at the board and there it was. I was like, hey, that name looks very familiar. So I go back into my documents of my genealogy and there it is.
I just sort of, whenever I show up, I just show up being extremely respectful of the history here and of the existing relationships that exist here. And I just sort of listen and I just, you know, humble myself. And when it feels right, when something is asked of me, or something opens up that sort of encourages me to, play a role in, then I'll do that if it feels right, you know, and if it's respectful and if it's, if I feel like that's why I'm here, you know.
It's a little bit of emotional roller coaster right now. Like, as a Native Hawaiian or Kanaka Maoli, it's kind of upsetting to see like what was done. And I guess for me, like as the next generation, it's kind of like, what can I do to help like restore this place? And so that's why I'm here today with my dad.
Very emotional. Good emotion though. I think it's a healing, not just for the Aina, but for the people as well, all of us, Kanaka and not Kanaka. Yeah? There's something special about being on land and working it. It's healing, to say the least. And just being here, being able to Malama protocol. I never thought I'd be able to do that in this valley.
At the Kahana Haiki Ahu, Uncle Sparky shared about the importance of these ahu for cultural practice in a valley under military occupation.
We wanted to offer ho'okupu to the site, but because it was a cultural site, you couldn't offer ho'okupu. So they were dictating what could be ho'okupu, how to put it, where to put it, and that was Army culture. That wasn't practice. And because we were separated for generations from the Aina, a lot of it is learned, relearned, and got to talk to the Aina and listen. So this right here was put up so that we could have makahiki and a place to offer ho'okupu without being dictated to.
Even with the three ahu in place, the conflict between Hawaiian cultural practice and Army archaeological standards arose again in 2019 at a complex of dry stacked stone walls near one of the old stream beds. The proper name of the site isn't known. The Army calls it 4546. The site is a little deeper into the valley towards the Ko'iahi side, hidden from view by stands of invasive haolekoa trees. We wind our way down a rough, rocky trail cut through the trees until a clearing opens out in front of us, where the foundations of rock walls trace out the patterns of the structures that used to stand there. As the others walked around the site, I asked Auntie Lynette and Uncle Sparky to share what happened here back in 2019. Later on, I also heard the story from Uncle Vince's perspective, who was at the center of the action, as well as Taylor Chang. Here are the stories that the four of them shared.
Here we are, we're walking down the trail to 4546. And we get down into the site. We go to the right, there's kind of some terrace, and then there's this big wall. There's a big like retaining wall with kind of like a partial platform. It's been eroded and whatnot and partially falling apart, but you can definitely see that it's an old, like ancient kind of structure, yeah? And we would gather at the base of it regularly, and we would offer ho'okupu there at that place. And it was Emily had brought along the little cardboard card with the description of William Punahou White and what his relationship to the Queen and to the Lahui was. And she, for like 10 minutes, explained who he was and why she was going to place this card as a ho'okupu at this in this particular site.
I recall her sharing a little bit about him, you know, who he was and how he was a patriot. And then after that sort of came to a close, I think we just were going to head back out maybe at that time.
Yes. I think we're like, okay, we're done. And then this head archaeologist announces that she needs to go and remove this piece of cardboard because it violates the Army's rules for ho'okupu. And I remember we're like, what? Like, there was definitely surprise and almost like stunned, like, what, you know?
And the archaeologist there at the time was not happy and said we can only use, I guess what, paper-based products, which to us is like cardstock.
Paper.
So anyway, we got into a little argument up there about what was and what was allowed. But that's the issue. Who are you to say, as an archaeologist, what is or what is not allowed? And at what point does it become your cultural access as opposed to ours?
Then there was like this interaction, conversation. There was multiple people, you know, trying to like understand what her deal was, like why this cardboard, which would biodegrade, was somehow in violation of the Army's, you know, ho'okupu protocol, which included, you know, that it was for them okay that it be plant-based, right? and not coral and not shells and not food. So it kind of met all those requirements. Yeah, I just remember Emily and Carla, like, really engaging with her.
I had my trusty phone, whipped it up, videotaped a portion of that.
So if the plant, so what you're saying, the plant-based material, the instruction that you're given is that plant-based material is okay, biodegradable material is okay. Is that something that's written actually in the contract, or is that something that was just conveyed to you as a definition, or as their particular definition?
And and she was resistant. Yeah, it didn't seem like we were going to be able to reason with her. And then I think it was Charles that said, oh, can we just take this conversation to the parking lot? Like, let's go, you know? Because it was hot. I remember it was like, I don't know, 2 p.m. Like, it was very hot. And then they had the archaeologist made a move to go, like, she was going to take it. She was going to remove the card. And so as all this discussion was going on, it was like 20 minutes of interaction, trying to convince her, trying to understand her. And I know that I stopped talking after a little while, and I stood between her and the card. And I just was tuning into the valley, because I have found that that's, well, the valley is in charge. You know, I've been really clear about that for many, many years. And so I was just kind of just tuning into the valley, what was going on. And I got very clearly that, nope, the whole kupu has been offered. There was an explanation of 10 minutes about what it was. And that would have been the appropriate time to say, I'm sorry, I don't think this quite meets the requirements. But now that it's been offered, you cannot take it back. So please protect it. And so I moved my body in between her and the whole kupu. And when she announced that she was going to remove it, I said, sorry, I'm not going to let you do that. Well, this is where it's going.
Okay.
You want to remove the paper?
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting instructions in the valley to say, no, I'm not going to let you do that. That's really not okay in this moment in time. So.
I understand that. Thank you.
And it's nothing personal.
Yep, and like this is nothing personal
it
either.
It isn't.
It's a blank in the rule.
We got you. We got you.
Mm-hmm. It's just a blank.
Just
in
because
the
rule. there's a gray or there's a blank, you know, it's like we don't need to suffer for it, and our cultural practice doesn't need to suffer for it. And I think that surprised her. I don't know. Maybe that surprised everybody.
What stood out to me was that. Because Uncle Vince, you're typically on those on accesses. You're always. I always admire how graceful you are in like mediating between the army support staff and the group. You know, the Malama Makua, as well as also the you know people who are joining us on the access. And there have been many times where I've seen you de-escalate and you sort of be the one to make things Noah and to like kind of calm down. And so it meant a lot. It stood out more when you were the one to take a stand and to be really firm.
So what happened next?
Okay. So immediately the head archaeologist's reaction is like, she said, all right, access is canceled. And we're like, okay. And she's like, well, let's go now. You know, like, let me go first. I said, oh, well, after you, you know, and she said, no, you go. And I was like, no, after you, because I know what you're going to, I know what you want to do. So, you know, I have my kuleana here, you know, and then she said something like, all right, we're calling the MPs.
I never come down. I never walked this far because of my back. So I was up in the truck waiting. And then somebody comes up and say, well, they're calling the MPs. So I'm saying, what the hell's going on? So I come down and I meet the archaeologist and she says, well, you can't leave this. It's a piece of paper. What are you talking about? So I kind of swore at her and she got pissed off. So I told her, you know what? I'm going to sit right here, call the MPs. When they come, they can carry me out because I'm not walking back. So I just laid down right here and waited.
He was upset. That's what I remember. Like he was like, what the hell is going on, right? You know? Yeah, like call the damn MPs or whatever, you know. right? And so I think those calls were made, right? That's the MP, military police. And then we stayed like right, we were in the sun, as I recall, protecting, you know, putting our bodies in the way of that head archaeologist so that she wouldn't make a grab. And then just kind of having a hangout, talk story, right?
Once it was clear there was going to be a stalemate, no one's going to move, I think we all stayed there for quite some time. It was like an hour in or something. And the sun was going down. But it was still, I mean, we stayed until the sun started going down. But in the lead up to that part, when it was starting to get dark, I remember going into the shade. And I think at some point, I don't know if it was Yonkovance or somebody else, gave everybody an opt-in, opt-out option. Because not everybody on that access, you know, I think was comfortable staying, you know, making this down or staying for however long it would take for it to get resolved. And so I remember for myself asking myself what I wanted to do at that point, like actually questioning myself whether I felt comfortable staying there and sticking it out to the end and potentially getting arrested by the military police, you know, which was, you know, a first six that was, you know, hadn't been put in that type of position before. And so I remember being in the shade with a few others, and there were folks who were like, you know, yeah, there was an offer for people to go into the car and to get driven back down to the parking lot. At some point. And I remember there was a small group of folks who took that opt-out option. And I don't think I went in that one. I stayed longer, stayed through the first wave of folks kind of opting out. Because I do remember staying until things were getting dark. And I think I was the only person. I think I went down right before the sun was starting to set, but I was the only person in the car when I had left the site. And then I had stick around.
I think, yeah, as I recall, you stayed because HPD showed up.
No, that's right. Thank you for the clarification. Yes. The HPD, yes, that was what triggered me to be like, oh shit, I need to stay. I wanted to stay in the parking lot. And I think they did arrive, and I think I did talk to them a little bit.
So then in the meantime, Sparky says, hey, it's getting late. It was after five already. This is February. The sun's going to set, you know, before six.
Then during that time, the sun was setting, and we got to be out by sunset.
Yeah.
So the archaeologist and whoever she was talking to, her boss, said, you guys got to go. I said, the problem is that piece of paper and you. If it's not for you and the paper stays, we got no problem. We can go now. I'll even walk out. But if you're insisting that ho'okupu has to be removed, I stay. You're going to have to carry me out and you're going to arrest me.
And he says, you know, he's talking to the head archaeologist and to Charles Donaldson. And he said, you know, your kuleana is safety. I'm kupuna. I have a bum leg and it's getting dark. That's a safety issue. Right? And they were like, oh, yeah. Oh, we better do something, right? So they kind of had their own meeting, and then they came back to us and said, well, can we all move to the parking lot? And we were like, we can move to the parking lot as long as you give us your word that you're not going to touch this whole kupu. And so they said, you have my word. We won't touch it. And so then we all went back up the trail to the road. Sparky got in the truck and we walked down. And yeah, it was late. It was around sunset by then. And as I recall, yeah, you were still in the parking lot because we were pleasantly surprised to see you. We asked you what's going on, and you said that, Taylor, oh, when you got to the parking lot, HPD pulled in, and so you wanted to, like, kind of de-escalate the situation with them, and you just ended up staying and talking to them, and they had just left. And then the MPs, as we were loading up in our cars, so like access was done, we said our goodbyes to each other, got in our cars, the MPs showed up. And somebody at some point realized that, they weren't in a rush to get there, because it was Super Bowl Sunday and the game was still on when they got the call, and they all the after game festivities, and they were in Schofield, they were an hour away. So yeah, that's kind of how that went down.
Super Bowl Sunday. Well, it definitely did shook me, I was like, no, yeah, it was the first time that I had experienced that inside the valley, and usually when I'm leaving the valley, it's such a beautiful, calming feeling, but that time it was definitely not that. It was disconcerting, to say the least. And I remember thinking to myself, like, did I do the right thing? I remember I was asking myself, like, yeah, did I make the right decisions in those moments, to take the stand or not take the stand, to, de-escalate things, or to, I remember asking myself, yeah, did I do the right thing? Like, did I, And I learned a lot from that experience, a lesson in like not being afraid of that, those tensions or those moments of, and it's a reminder that those tensions exist, that no matter how beautiful our experience can be in Makua, that there's still this, it's the army is still there, it's still not truly ours yet. It's not truly, the valley hasn't truly been given back to the Lahui. That's what I mean when I say it's not truly ours. It hasn't been back to the Lahui yet. And so it was a reminder that is in fact a reality that need to not get too complacent. I guess I learned, and I'm continuing to learn lessons from that experience, like when you need to take this stand, like what will you and how will you, and at what times are the right moments to do that? And when you hear a call, how do you act?
The other experience was force. It was out of proportion to what was going on, that they not only called the MPs, but they called the police. And so by the time we got down to the gate, which was not that long, there's police everywhere. And so we're like, oh, my goodness. But we don't regret it. And these things have to happen, because even though there's a willingness to let us in and do this and the other, and they cut the grass for us so we can come up, and they put in new ropes. And the reality is we are here at their discretion. And at some point, that has got to change. Number one, they're trying to protect us. And number two, they created the situation where we need to be protected from the harm that they perpetrated in the beginning, unexploded ordnance. So now, it's kind of like I'm going to come off like the good guy because I care about your safety. And like, too bad you didn't think about it back in like 1940s when you were bombing the place. So we have to keep reminding them. Otherwise, we come across as being somewhat ungrateful for the opportunity to be able to visit our own places.
I think that I was like tickled, actually, because you had all this like sort of confrontation and build up and, threats and whatnot. And then we got to hang out a couple extra hours in the valley and just hang and relax and talk story, And then, we basically called them on their own kuleana, right? We had the agreement that we wanted it from the very beginning, right? Which is you leave that hokupu alone and we're all good. And then we get in our cars. We're loading, stepping into our cars, and here comes the military police. So, we're like, see ya. Yeah, I think it tickled, and I think also just it was confirmation that was the directive of the valley.
Oh, Tutu, tell me where the people going today. Oh, Tutu, tell me where the people going today. They're going down Makua, bring Ho'okupu and pray. They're going down Makua, bring Ho'okupu and pray.
But at some point, we started to have some conversations about resolving this. It took like 3.5 years of some back and forth to come to the agreement to try using lele at these sites, where then the hokupu could be offered on the lele, not on the actual stones of the site. And that was something that then the army would have no place to interfere with, and Malama Makua would have the responsibility of taking care of the hokupu and making sure that it was appropriate and whatnot. And just for so folks, if they're not clear what a lele is, that's a kind of like a tripod or a pyramid type structure, often made with bamboo. The ones that we made were made with bamboo lashed together, and there'll be one or two levels, horizontal levels, like little shelves that you can place offerings on. And so we constructed one of them in Makua. Yeah. And you were there that day, Taylor, yeah? That was that freezing cold, windy, rainy, was like horizontal rain blowing into the pavilion.
And I remember like that access. It was also kind of like it felt serendipitous, because it was another access where I was just like, I'm just going to show up and I'm just going to go. Yeah. I didn't expect it would take us full circle for the Super Bowl Sunday. You know, I don't think I knew beforehand that, you know, that the lele was going to be completed, and that we were going to, you know, it was going to be, you know, used for the first time. And so when I showed up to that access, it just felt serendipitous. That I decided to come on that particular one, so I I'll always remember that.
Me too. I was like, "Oh, Taylor is here! Wow!" Because as I recall, you and I were the only two people on that access that had been there on February 19th, and yeah. I was like, "Wow, this is awesome, right?"
Yeah.
And because it was raining so much, we didn't even know if we would be able to place the lele in that site. And then, freezing rain for a couple of hours. And then, you know, everybody practicing and tying the lele up. And then it stopped raining. Right? And there was like a 30 or 40 minute window. There was no rain. And we're like, load it up in the truck. Let's go to the site.
And then I remember you had one of the same cards.
Yes.
Of William Punahou White was.
Yes. It was from February 19th. It had been riding around in my backpack for like 4 years. Yeah, for nearly 4 years. It was in my backpack, and I realized, oh my God, it's a little, you know, little worn, but there he was. And then I remember, Taylor, we asked you if you would do the blessing. Yeah. For to kind of like christen or to introduce that lele.
It's amazing that it was 4 years, that it was a 4 year, you know, kind of a cycle, I suppose. You know, when you had asked if I could, you know, give Oli at that time, it felt right that I was there, I guess, you know. I remember thinking about, you know, Emily, you know, when she had first given the offer 4 years prior. And I remember thinking about what my intention would be, you know. And I use the same Oli that I usually offer when I when I, you know, when I enter Makua, it's just like infinite aloha, essentially, is what it's putting forth and asking for guidance and wisdom, and that's never ending. You know, it's like never ending aloha combined with, you know, the sort of never ending humility. And I guess for me, offering that oli, I guess there's multiple dimensions to that. There was though in the personal front, it was, you know, kind of healing that the tension that and the conflict that I had felt 4 years prior, you know, that kind of that whatever that was that was still with me, that kind of that feeling of conflict and tension that I was giving an oli to asking for guidance and aloha to, you know, heal that and evolve through that. And it was an honor to be able to offer that oli at that particular time. And hoping that everyone that was with us could also have that aloha and also be asking for that guidance, you know, as we move forward. Yeah, I hope I was able to do what I needed to do in that moment. Yeah.
I think very definitely, and I think I recall by the time we got, you know, we left, and by the time we walked out to the Koyahi Ahu, like, that whole site was already in the mist again, you know, so it was just that, like, one window that opened.
Over two decades of cultural access, Malama Makua and community members have been able to renew relationships with the valley, working towards the healing of both themselves and the Aina. Cultural access is a product of Malama Makua's legal battle with the army, ultimately forcing the army into a working relationship with Malama Makua. But as Uncle Vince likes to say, it's the valley that's calling the shots.
Oh Makua, tell us how to heal your pain. Oh Makua, tell us how to heal your pain. Look for the answer in the Ulalena rain.
In the next episode, we're going back to the time before the army occupied the valley to hear the last living memory of the community in Makua before the war.
Makua, soon you will be free. Aina pula pula from the mountains to the sea. Aina lana kila from the mountains to the sea. Aina ika pono from the mountains to the sea. Aina ikea from the mountains to the sea.
Before Us is a podcast produced by me, Kenji Cataldo. The series Makua Piku of Peace is produced in collaboration with Malama Makua. A big thank you today to the many people who shared their voices on this episode. David Henkin, Uncle Sparky Rodriguez, Uncle Vince Dodge, Auntie Lynette Cruz, Taylor Chang, Nathan Rout, Anela Fernandez, Ulana Kalahiki Anthony, and Charisma Fojas. The theme music was created by No Drama. Mahalo nui to Punahele for sharing his track Pili La'au for the podcast. And thank you for listening. Ahui ho!